3.
Instant Ubik has all the fresh flavor of just-brewed drip coffee. Your husband will say, "Christ, Sally, I used to think your coffee was only so-so, but now, wow!" Safe when taken as directed. Still in gray pinstripe clown-style pajamas, Joe Chip hazily seated himself at his kitchen table, lit a cigarette, and after inserting a dime, twiddled the dial of his recently rented pape machine. Having a hangover, he dialed off Interplan News, hovered momentarily at Domestic News, and then selected Gossip.
"Yes, sir," the pape machine said heartily. "Gossip. Guess what Stanton Mick, the reclusive interplanetary known speculator and financier, is up to at this very moment."
Its works whizzed, and a scroll of printed matter crept from its slot. The ejected roll, a document in four colors, niftily incised with bold type, rolled across the surface of the neotique wood table and bounced to the floor. His head aching, Chip retrieved it, spread it out flat before him.
"Mick hits World Bank for $2 trillion.
AP London. What could Stanton Mick, the reclusive interplanetarily known speculator and financier, be up to? The business community asked itself, as rumor leaked out of Whitehall that the dashing but peculiar industrial magnate, who once offered to build free of charge a fleet by which Israel could colonize and make fertile, otherwise desert areas of Mars, had asked for, and may possibly receive, a staggering and unprecedented loan of...
"This isn't gossip," Joe Chip said to the paper machine. "This is speculation about fiscal transactions. Today I want to read about which TV star is sleeping with whose drug-addicted wife."
He had, as usual, not slept well, at least in terms of REM, rapid eye movement, sleep, and he had resisted taking a soporific because, very unfortunately, his week's supply of stimulants provided him by the autonomic pharmacy of his Conap building had run out, due, admittedly, to his own oral greed, but nonetheless gone. By law, he could not approach the pharmacy for more until next Tuesday, 2 days away, 2 long days. The pape machine said,
"Set the dial for low gossip."
He did so, and a second scroll excreted by the pape machine without delay emerged. He zoomed in on an excellent caricature drawing of Lola Hertzberg Wright, licked his lips with satisfaction at the naughty exposure of her entire right ear, then feasted on the text. "Accosted by a cut purse in a fancy New York after-hours mowl the other night, Lola Hertzberg Wright bounced a swift right jab off the chops of the do-batter, which sent him reeling onto the table where King Egon Groat of Sweden and an unidentified miss with astonishingly large..." The ring construct of his Conap door jangled. Startled, Joe Chip glanced up, found his cigarette attempting to burn the formica surface of his neo-teakwood table, coped with that, then shuffled blearily to the speak tube mounted handily by the release bolt of the door.
"Who is it?" he grumbled. Checking with his wristwatch, he saw that 8 o'clock had not arrived. "Probably the rent robot," he decided, "or a creditor."
He did not trigger off the release bolt of the door.
An enthusiastic male voice from the door's speaker exclaimed,
"I know it's early, Joe, but I just hit town. G.G. Ashwood here. I've got a firm prospect that I snared in Topeka. I read this one as magnificent, and I want your confirmation before I lay the pitch in Runciter's lap. Anyhow, he's in Switzerland."
Chip said, "I don't have my test equipment in the apt."
"I'll shoot over to the shop and pick it up for you."
"It's not at the shop."
Reluctantly, he admitted,
"It's in my car. I didn't get around to unloading it last night."
In actuality, he had been too pizzled on Parapot to get the trunk of his hover car open.
"Can't it wait until after 9? He asked irritably. G.G. Ashwood's unstable manic energy annoyed him even at noon. This, at 7:40, struck him as downright impossible, worse even than a creditor.
"Chip, dearie, this is a sweet number, a walking symposium of miracles that'll curl the needles of your gauges and, in addition, give new life to the firm, which it badly needs. And furthermore..."
"It's an anti-what?" Joe Chip asked. "Telepath?"
"I'll lay it on you right out in front," G.G. Ashwood declared. "I don't know." "Listen, Chip," Ashwood lowered his voice, "this is confidential, this particular one. I can't stand down here at the gate, gum flapping away out loud. Somebody might overhear. In fact, I'm already picking up the thoughts of some glunk in a ground-level apt. He—"
"Okay," Joe Chip said, resigned. Once started, G.G. Ashwood's relentless monologues couldn't be aborted anyhow. He might as well listen to it. "Give me 5 minutes to get dressed and find out if I've got any coffee left in the apt anywhere."
He had a quasi-memory of shopping last night at the Conapt supermarket. In particular, a memory of tearing out a green ration stamp, which could mean either coffee or tea or cigarettes or fancy imported snuff.
"You'll like her," G.G. Ashwood stated energetically. "Although, as often happens, she's the daughter of a... her."
In alarm, Joe Chip said, "My apt's unfit to be seen. I'm behind in my payments to the building cleanup robots. They haven't been inside here in 2 weeks."
"I'll ask her if she cares."
"Don't ask her. I care. I'll test her out down at the shop on Runciter's time."
"I read her mind, and she doesn't care."
"How old is she?"
Maybe he thought she's only a child. Quite a few new and potential inertials were children, having developed their ability in order to protect themselves against their psionic parents.
"How old are you, dear?"
G.G. Ashwood asked faintly, turning his head away to speak to the person with him.
19, he reported to Joe Chip.
"Well, that shot that."
But now he had become curious. G.G. Ashwood's razzle-dazzle wound-up tightness usually manifested itself in conjunction with attractive women. Maybe this girl fell into that category.
"Give me 15 minutes, he told G.G. If he worked fast and skulked about in a clean-up campaign, and if he missed both coffee and breakfast, he could probably effect a tidy apt by then. At least it seemed worth trying. He rang off, then searched in the cupboards of the kitchen for a broom, manual or self-powered, or vacuum cleaner, helium battery, or wall socket. Neither could be found. Evidently, he had never been issued any sort of cleaning equipment by the building's supply agency. Hell of a time, he thought, to find that out. And he had lived here 4 years. Picking up the vidphone, he dialed 214, the extension for the maintenance circuit of the building.
"Listen," he said when the homeostatic entity answered, "I'm now in a position to divert some of my funds in the direction of settling my bill vis-a-vis your cleanup robots. I'd like them up here right now to go over my apt. I'll pay the full and entire bill when they're finished."
"Sir, you'll pay your full and entire bill before they start."
By now he had his billfold in hand. From it he dumped his supply of magic credit keys, most of which by now had been voided. Probably in perpetuity, his relationship with money and the payment of pressing debts being such as it was.
"I'll charge my overdue bill against my triangular magic key," he informed his nebulous antagonist. "That will transfer the obligation out of your jurisdiction. On your books it'll show as total restitution."
"Plus fines, plus penalties."
"I'll charge those against my heart-shaped—"
"Mr. Chip, the Ferris and Brockman Retail Credit Auditing and Analysis Agency has published a special flyer on you. Our recept slot received it yesterday, and it remains fresh in our minds. Since July, you've dropped from a triple G status credit-wise to quadruple G. Our department—in fact, this entire CONAP building—is now programmed against an extension of services and or credit to such pathetic anomalies as yourself, sir. Regarding you, everything must hereafter be handled on a basic cash subfloor. In fact, you'll probably be on a basic cash subfloor for the rest of your life. In fact—"
He hung up and abandoned the hope of enticing and or threatening the clean-up robots into entering his muddled apt. Instead, he padded into the bedroom to dress. He could do that without assistance. After he had dressed, in a sporty maroon wrapper, twinkle-toes turned-up shoes, and a felt cap with a tassel, he poked around hopefully in the kitchen for some manifestation of coffee. None. He then focused on the living room and found, by the door leading to the bathroom, last night's great cape, every spotty blue yard of it, and a plastic bag which contained a half-pound can of authentic Kenya coffee. A great treat, and one which only while pizzled would he have risen to, especially in view of his current abominable financial situation. Back in the kitchen, he fished in his various pockets for a dime, and with it started up the coffee pot. Sniffing the, to him, very unusual smell, he again consulted his watch, saw that 15 minutes had passed. He therefore vigorously strode to the apt door, turned the knob, and pulled on the release bolt. The door refused to open. It said,
5 cents, please.
He searched his pockets. No more coins, nothing. I'll pay you tomorrow, he told the door. Again he tried the knob. Again it remained locked tight. What I pay you, he informed it, is in the nature of a gratuity. I don't have to pay you.
I think otherwise, the door said. Look in the purchase contract you signed when you bought this Conapp.
In his desk drawer he found the contract. Since signing it, he had found it necessary to refer to the document many times. Sure enough, payment to his door for opening and shutting constituted a mandatory fee, not a tip.
You discover I'm right, the door said. It sounded smug.
From the drawer beside the sink, Joe Chip got a stainless steel knife. With it, he began systematically to unscrew the bolt assembly of his apt's money-gulping door.
I'll sue you,
the door said as the first screw fell out. Joe Chip said, I've never been sued by a door, but I guess I can live through it. A knock sounded on the door.
Hey, Joe, baby, it's me, G.G. Ashwood, and I've got it right here with me. Open up.
Put a nickel in the slot for me, Joe said. The mechanism seems to be jammed on my side. A coin rattled down into the works of the door. It swung open, and there stood G.G. Ashwood with a brilliant look on his face. It pulsed with sly intensity, an erratic, gleaming triumph, as he propelled the girl forward and into the apt. She stood for a moment staring at Joe, obviously no more than 17, slim and copper-skinned, with large dark eyes. My God, he thought, she's beautiful. She wore an ersatz canvas work shirt and jeans, heavy boots caked with what appeared to be authentic mud. Her tangle of shiny hair was tied back and knotted with a red bandana. Her rolled-up sleeves showed tanned, competent arms. At her imitation leather belt she carried a knife, a field telephone unit, and an emergency pack of rations and water. On her bare, dark forearm he made out a tattoo. Caveat emptor, it read. He wondered what that meant.
This is Pat,
G.G. Ashwood said, his arm with ostentatious familiarity around the girl's waist.
Never mind her last name.
Square and puffy like an overweight brick, wearing his usual mohair poncho, apricot-colored felt hat, argyle ski socks, and carpet slippers, he advanced toward Joe Chip, self-satisfaction smirking from every molecule in his body. He had found something of value here, and he meant to make the most of it.
Pat, this is the company's highly skilled first-line electrical type tester.
Coolly, the girl said to Joe Chip, is it you that's electrical? Or your tests?
We trade off, Joe said.
He felt, from all around him, the miasma of his uncleaned-up apt. It radiated the specter of debris and clutter, and he knew that Pat had already noticed.
Sit down, he said awkwardly. Have a cup of actual coffee.
Such luxury, Pat said, seating herself at the kitchen table. Reflexively, she gathered the week's heap of papers into a neater pile. How can you afford real coffee, Mr. Chip?
G.G. Ashwood said, Joe gets paid a hell of a lot. The firm couldn't operate without him.
Reaching out, he took a cigarette from the package lying on the table.
Put it back, Joe Chip said. I'm almost out, and I used up my last green ration stamp on the coffee.
I paid for the door, G.G. pointed out.
He offered the pack to the girl.
Joe puts on an act, pay no attention. Like, look how he keeps his place. Shows he's creative. All geniuses live like this. Where's your test equipment, Joe? We're wasting time.
To the girl, Joe said, you're dressed oddly. I maintain the subsurface vidphone lines at the Topeka kibbutz, Pat said. Only women can hold jobs involving manual labor at that particular kibbutz. That's why I applied there instead of the Wichita Falls kibbutz. Her black eyes blazed pridefully.
Joe said, that inscription on your arm, that tattoo, is that Hebrew?
Latin. Her eyes veiled her amusement. I've never seen an app so cluttered with rubbish. Don't you have a mistress?
These electrical expert types have no time for taradiddle, G.G. Ashwood said irritably. Listen, Chip, this girl's parents work for Ray Hollis. If they knew she was here, they'd give her a frontal lobotomy.
To the girl, Joe Chip said, they don't know you have a counter-talent? No, she shook her head. I didn't really understand it either until your scout sat down with me in the kibbutz cafeteria and told me. Maybe it's true, she shrugged. Maybe not.
He said you could show me objective proof of it with your testing battery.
How would you feel, he asked her, if the tests show that you have it?
Reflecting, Pat said, it seems so negative.
I don't do anything.
I don't move objects or turn stones into bread or give birth without impregnation or reverse the illness process in sick people or read minds or look into the future. Not even common talents like that. I just negate somebody else's ability. It seems, she gestured, stultifying.
As a survival factor for the human race, Joe said, it's as useful as the psi talents, especially for us norms. The anti-psi factor is a natural restoration of ecological balance. One insect learns to fly, so another learns to build a web to trap him. Is that the same as no flight? Clams developed hard shells to protect them. Therefore, birds learn to fly the clam up high in the air and drop him on a rock. In a sense, you're a life form preying on the psis, and the psis are life forms that prey on the norms. That makes you a friend of the norm class. Balance, the full circle, predator and prey. It appears to be an eternal system, and frankly, I can't see how it could be improved.
I might be considered a traitor, Pat said.
Does it bother you?
It bothers me that people will feel hostile toward me. But I guess you can't live very long without arousing hostility. You can't please everybody because people want different things. Please one, and you displease another.
Joe said, what is your anti-talent?
It's hard to explain.
Like I say, G.G. Ashwood said, it's unique. I never heard of it before.
Which psi talent does it counteract? Joe asked the girl. Precog, Pat said, I guess.
She indicated G.G. Ashwood, whose smirk of enthusiasm had not dimmed.
Your scout, Mr. Ashwood, explained it to me. I knew I did something funny. I've always had these strange periods in my life, starting in my 6th year. I never told my parents, because I sensed that it would displease them.
Are they precogs?
Joe asked. Yes.
You're right. It would have displeased them. But if you used it around them even once, they would have known. Didn't they suspect? Didn't you interfere with their ability?
Pat said, she gestured. I think I did interfere, but they didn't know it. Her face showed bewilderment.
Let me explain, Joe said, how the anti-precog generally functions. Functions, in fact, in every case we know of. The precog sees a variety of futures laid out side by side, like cells in a beehive. For him, one has greater luminosity, and this he picks. Once he has picked it, the anti-precog can do nothing. The anti-precog has to be present when the precog is in the process of deciding, not after. The anti-precog makes all futures seem equally real to the precog. He aborts his talent to choose at all. A precog is instantly aware when an anti-precog is nearby because his entire relation to the future is altered. In the case of telepaths, a similar impairment...
She goes back in time. G.G. Ashwood said.
Joe stared at him.
Back in time,
G.G. repeated, savoring this. His eyes shot shafts of significance to every part of Joe Chip's kitchen.
The precog affected by her still sees one predominant future, like you said, the one luminous possibility, and he chooses it, and he's right. But why is it right? Why is it luminous? Because this girl,
he shrugged in her direction,
controls the future. That one luminous possibility is luminous because she's gone into the past and changed it. By changing it, she changes the present, which includes the precog. He's affected without knowing it, and his talent seems to work, whereas it really doesn't. So, that's one advantage of her anti-talent over other anti-precog talents. The other, and greater, is that she can cancel out the precog's decision after he's made it. She can enter the situation later on, and this problem has always hung us up, as you know. If we didn't get in there from the start, we couldn't do anything. In a way, we never could truly abort the precog ability as we've done with the others, right? Hasn't that been a weak link in our services?
He eyed Joe Chip expectantly.
Interesting, Joe said presently.
Hell, interesting, G.G. Ashwood thrashed about indignantly. This is the greatest anti-talent to emerge thus far.
In a low voice, Pat said,
I don't go back in time. She raised her eyes, confronted Joe Chip half apologetically, half belligerently. I do something, but Mr. Ashwood has built it up all out of proportion to reality.
I can read your mind, Gigi said to her, looking a little nettled. I know you can change the past. You've done it.
Pat said, I can change the past, but I don't go into the past. I don't time travel, as you want your tester to think.
How do you change the past? Joe asked her.
I think about it. One specific aspect of it, such as one incident or something somebody said, or a little thing that happened that I wish hadn't happened. The first time I did this, as a child,
when she was 6 years old, Gigi broke in, living in Detroit with her parents, of course, she broke a ceramic antique statue that her father treasured.
Didn't your father foresee it? Joe asked her,
with his precog ability. He foresaw it, Pat answered, and he punished me the week before I broke the statue. But he said it was inevitable. You know the precog talent. They can foresee, but they can't change anything. Then, after the statue did break, after I broke it, I should say, I brooded about it, and I thought about that week before it broke when I didn't get any dessert at dinner and had to go to bed at 5 p.m. I thought, Christ, or whatever a kid says, isn't there some way these unfortunate events can be averted? My father's precog ability didn't seem very spectacular to me, since he couldn't alter events. I still feel that way, a sort of contempt. I spent a month trying to will the damn statue back into one piece. In my mind, I kept going back to before it broke, imagining what it had looked like, which was awful. And then, one morning when I got up, I even dreamed about it at night. There it stood, as it used to be.
Tensely, she leaned toward Joe Chip. She spoke in a sharp, determined voice.
But neither of my parents noticed anything. It seemed perfectly normal to them that the statue was in one piece. They thought it had always been in one piece. I was the only one who remembered.
She smiled, leaned back, took another of his cigarettes from the pack, and lit up. I'll go get my test equipment from the car, Joe said, starting toward the door.
5 cents, please,
the door said as he seized its knob. Pay the door, Joe said to Gigi Ashwood. When he had lugged his armload of testing apparatus from the car to his aft, he told the firm scout to hit the road.
What? Gigi said, astounded. But I found her! The bounty is mine! I spent almost 10 days tracing the field to her.
Joe said to him. I can't test her with your field present, as you well know. Talent and anti-talent fields deform each other. If they didn't, we wouldn't be in this line of business.
He held out his hand as Gigi got grumpily to his feet.
And leave me a couple of nickels, so she and I can get out of here.
I have change, Pat murmured, in my purse.
You can measure the force she creates, Gigi said, by the loss within my field. I've seen you do it that way 100 times.
Joe said briefly, This is different.
I don't have any more nickels, Gigi said. I can't get out.
Glancing at Joe, then at Gigi, Pat said,
Have one of mine.
She tossed Gigi a coin, which he caught, an expression of bewilderment on his face. The bewilderment then by degrees changed to a grieved sullenness.
You sure shot me down, he said as he deposited the nickel in the door slot. Both of you, he muttered as the door closed after him. I discovered her. This is really a cutthroat business.
His voice faded out as the door clamped shut. There was, then, silence. Presently, Pat said,
When his enthusiasm goes, there isn't much left of him.
He's okay, Joe said. He felt a usual feeling, guilt, but not very much. Anyhow, he did his part. Now
it's your turn, Pat said. So to speak. May I take off my boots?
Sure, he said. He began to set up his test equipment, checking the drums, the power supply. He started trial motions of each needle, releasing specific surges and recording their effect.
A shower?
She asked as she set her boots neatly out of the way. A quarter, he murmured. Costs a quarter.
He glanced up at her and saw that she had begun unbuttoning her blouse.
I don't have a quarter, he said.
At the kibbutz, Pat said, everything is free.
Free? He stared at her. That's not economically feasible. How can it operate on that basis for more than a month?
She continued unperturbedly unbuttoning her blouse. Our salaries are paid in, and we're credited with having done our job. The aggregate of our earnings underwrites the kibbutz as a whole. Actually, the Topeka kibbutz has shown a profit for several years. We as a group are putting in more than we're taking out.
Having unbuttoned her blouse, she laid it over the back of her chair. Under the blue coarse blouse, she wore nothing, and he perceived her breasts, hard and high, held well by the accurate muscles of her shoulders.
"Are you sure you want to do that?" he said. "Take off your clothes, I mean?"
Pat said, "You don't remember."
"Remember what?"
"My not taking off my clothes. In another present. You didn't like that very well, so I eradicated that, hence this." She stood up lightly.
"What did I do?" he asked cautiously. "When you didn't take off your clothes, refused to test you?"
"You mumbled something about Mr. Ashwood having overrated my anti-talent."
Joe said, "I don't work that way. I don't do that."
"Here."
Bending, her breasts wagging forward, she rummaged in the pocket of her blouse, brought forth a folded sheet of paper, which she handed him.
"From the previous present, the one I abolished."
He read it, read his one-line evaluation at the end. "Anti-psi field generated, inadequate, below standard throughout. No value against precog ratings now in existence." And then the code mark, which he employed, a circle with a stroke dividing it. "Do not hire," the symbol meant. And only he and Glenn Runciter knew that. Not even their scouts knew the meaning of the symbol. So Ashwood could not have told her. Silently, he returned the paper to her. She refolded it and returned it to her blouse pocket.
"Do you need to test me?" she asked. "After seeing that?"
"I have a regular procedure," Joe said. "6 indices, which..."
Pat said, "You're a little debt-stricken, ineffective bureaucrat who can't even scrape together enough coins to pay his door to let him out of his apt."
Her tone, neutral but devastating, rebounded in his ears. He felt himself stiffen, wince, and violently flush.
"This is a bad spot right now," he said. "I'll be back on my feet financially any day now. I can get a loan from the firm if necessary."
He rose unsteadily, got 2 cups and 2 saucers, poured coffee from the coffee pot. "Sugar?" he said. "Cream?"
"Cream," Pat said, still standing barefoot without her blouse.
He fumbled for the door handle of the refrigerator to get out a carton of milk.
10 cents, please," the refrigerator said. 5 cents for opening my door, 5 cents for the cream."
"It isn't cream," he said. "It's plain milk." He continued to pluck futilely at the refrigerator door. "Just this one time," he said to it. "I swear to God I'll pay you back tonight."
"Here,"
Pat said. She slid a dime across the table toward him.
"She should have money," she said, as she watched him put the dime in the slot of the refrigerator. "Your mistress? You really have failed, haven't you? I knew it when Mr. Ashwood—"
"It isn't," he grated, "always like this."
"Do you want me to bail you out of your problems, Mr. Chip?"
Hands in the pockets of her jeans, she regarded him expressionlessly, no emotion clouding her face, only alertness.
"You know I can. Sit down and write out your evaluation report on me. Forget the tests. My talent is unique anyway. You can't measure the field I produce. It's in the past. And you're testing me in the present, which simply takes place as an automatic consequence. Do you agree?"
He said, "Let me see that evaluation sheet you have in your blouse. I want to look at it one more time before I decide."
From her blouse, she once more brought forth the folded-up yellow sheet of paper. She calmly passed it across the table to him, and he reread it.
"My writing," he said to himself. "Yes, it's true."
He returned it to her, and from the collection of testing items took a fresh, clean sheet of the same familiar yellow paper. On it he wrote her name, then spurious, extraordinarily high test results, and then at last his conclusions, his new conclusions. "Has unbelievable power. Anti-psi field unique in scope. Can probably negate any assembly of precogs imaginable."
After that, he scratched a symbol, this time two crosses, both underlined. Pat, standing behind him, watched him write. He felt her breath on his neck.
"What do the two underlined crosses mean?" she asked.
"Hire her," Joe said, "at whatever cost required."
"Thank you."
She dug into her purse, brought out a handful of Poscred bills, selected one and presented it to him, a big one.
"This will help you with expenses. I couldn't give it to you earlier before you made your official evaluation of me. You would have canceled very nearly everything, and you would have gone to your grave thinking I had bribed you. Ultimately, you would have even decided that I had no counter-talent."
She then unzipped her jeans and resumed her quick, furtive undressing.
Joe Chip examined what he had written, not watching her. The underlined crosses did not symbolize what he had told her. They meant, "Watch this person. She is a hazard to the firm. She is dangerous." He signed the test paper, folded it, and passed it to her. She at once put it away in her purse.
"When can I move my things in here?" she asked as she padded toward the bathroom. "I consider it mine, as of now, since I've already paid you what must be virtually the entire month's rent."
"Any time," he said.
The bathroom said,
"$0.50, please, before turning on the water."
Pat padded back into the kitchen to reach into her purse.